Appreciate you joining us this afternoon. My name is Mark Tallman. I'm going to start out with the first presentation, and it is on the Whole Genome Selection Project involving 2,000 industry AI sires at the U.S. Mayhem Research Center. So I'm going to start off with a little introduction, go through the 2,000 bull project with you, and then move into what we're using for training data, go through the validation data and process, industry application, wrap up with some conclusions. Before I get into too much of the details, we'll just go through a few brief definitions. You've heard most of these referred to in the last 2 days, I think, but the genome is just the whole set of DNA in an animal. Genetic markers can track regions of the genome. They may be linked to or explain phenotypes that we observe. SNP you've heard about a lot. It's single nucleotide polymorphism. It's a change in the DNA sequence at a specific location in the genome. And a genotype is the form of DNA that's present at a specific location in the genome. You've heard about the 50K chip over the last couple of days. This has really been a major advancement in the technology that's available to us to study the relationships between DNA polymorphisms and economically important traits. So you've also heard a lot about whole genome selection. I'm going to give you my version of what it's about. With whole genome selection, we use genotypes of thousands or tens of thousands of genetic markers like SNPs to predict breeding values. They're like the marker sets for traits being offered now, but with much greater density. The genetic differences in DNA that cause phenotypic differences are likely to be close to many of these markers, although some of our speakers emphasized yesterday, maybe not as close as we would like for them to be. We maybe would like to have a little bit greater marker density than we have even with 50,000 markers, which sounds like an awful lot. Whole genome selection accounts appropriately for ambiguity regarding which SNP influence which traits. And I think that's the most important aspect of whole genome selection is that it doesn't assume that we know exactly which markers affect which traits, but instead it allows us to operate in the face of uncertainty. And as I mentioned in a committee yesterday, that's really what breeders have been doing for many, many years, and what has been effective in producing genetic changes. Not worrying about being 100% right all the time, but operating effectively in the face of uncertainty. And that's the part of whole genome selection that really excites me and appeals to me. And the reason for that is that it allows SNP with smaller effects on target traits to be used effectively. If we want to restrict ourselves to only those markers that we can be absolutely sure about, we're going to miss the SNPs that have smaller effects. And as you heard several times yesterday, most of the variation is probably accounted for by SNPs that have very small effects, and we probably could never really identify unambiguously by themselves. But collectively, a large number, hundreds or thousands of these SNPs, probably account for a lot of genetic variation, and whole genome selection gives us the tool to manage that genetic variation more efficiently than we could do without DNA markers. So the problem was that whole genome selection from an infrastructure perspective seems to be a big leap in technology that we need to either implement in a big way or not at all. It's kind of hard to go part way on it. It really needs to be incorporated into national cattle evaluation in order for it to be utilized very effectively. So if we don't jump in a pretty big way, the early adopters are likely to receive relatively little benefit until we get to a critical mass of influential and extensively phenotyped animals, and it's all been tested and the data's been analyzed through the national cattle evaluation system. So because of that, the U.S. Meow Research Center called in a number of the breed associations to visit with us about a year ago maybe that was 2 years ago. And it must have been 2 years ago. And the ARS offered to provide 50K genotypes on a large number of industry AI sires if the breed associations would identify those sires and provide the semen to us to use as a DNA source for the project. And we were really excited that all 16 of the breed associations that register the most cattle in the U.S. and have genetic evaluation systems for beef production traits did decide to join in this collaborative effort with us. And so we're really excited about this project. The way it was structured is the breed associations identified the sires and provided semen. We asked them to go out and find bulls that were still candidates for selection for the most part, but to the extent possible, we wanted bulls that were high accuracy bulls that either already were influential within the breed or were relatively certain to become highly influential within those breeds. The U.S. Mark ran the 50K chip on those bulls, about 2,000 of them, and we are providing an extensively phenotyped population to use as a training data set for this project. So the objectives were to extend genetic predictions from U.S. Mark phenotypes to industry bulls. So we want to produce EPDs, or I think in today's nomenclature we probably should say MBVs, for traits not typically reported, for example feed efficiency, and we wanted to deliver those to the breed associations, and then they have the option to use those however they like. We would hope that they would make those MBVs available to their membership and the public. And our hope was that this would lead to the development and use of commercial products to genotype additional animals with the 50K chip so that we could actually have a real market for 50K genotyping for whole genome selection available to the beef industry. This may not be the tool that solves all of our needs for DNA testing in the beef industry because it's still going to have a reasonably high cost per animal, but it provides the most information per animal of anything that at least is available to us currently and for the immediate future. So we believe that, we wanted to use this as a demonstration project to validate the effectiveness of whole genome selection and to validate these molecular breeding values relative to the EPDs on the highly influential AI sires, most of which had high accuracy EPDs for a number of traits, especially for the growth traits and to a lesser extent for carcass traits and a few other traits that we might be interested in. We hope then that this would improve the accuracy of the EPDs for common traits as the MBVs became integrated into the National Cattle Evaluation System. And as some of the speakers yesterday emphasized, where this really helps in improving accuracy is that we get to a higher accuracy early in the life of the animal, and the genetic gains really come for these kinds of traits from reducing generation interval. That's where the real opportunity is. And then at the time that we started this project, it was really unclear to us to what extent DNA tests were going to need to be breed-specific. We were all thinking about it. We were all wondering how applicable are these tests going to be across breed. We had an example in some of the SNPs that have a big effect on tenderness where some of these SNPs seem to be in pretty good association across a pretty broad range of breeds. But we also were concerned that that might not be the general case. I think the speakers yesterday have indicated that we've got to be prepared for some of these predictions to be more breed-specific than we had hoped we might have to be. There's also hope that if we really increase the marker density a lot, maybe we can get beyond that in the longer term. But I think for the shorter term, we're really thinking that associations are a lot more likely to have to be at least partly breed specific. But we didn't know that when we started, and the project was designed to help us answer that, and I think it is going to be productive in helping us to get a clearer picture of that situation. So this is the number of sires that we sampled from each of the 16 participating breeds. We had a maximum of 402 down to 27 sires per breed, and that gave us a total of 2,026 AI sires that we've run the 50K chip across. Should mention that this includes bulls that were used in the germplasm evaluation project at US Mark, and so not all of these bulls are available as an independent validation resource relative to our discovery data, but we do have a total of 2,000 bulls across these 16 breeds. As I indicated earlier, the breed associations were responsible for selecting the sires. We really emphasized that we wanted these sires to be candidates for selection so that as we developed MBVs for these bulls, that the breeds actually could then use those MBVs in selection. And we weren't just going through an academic exercise that gave us MBVs for a lot of bulls that we already had evaluate. This is more important for the traits for which we don't currently have EPDs through our National Cattle Evaluation System. At the same time, we wanted the bulls to be high accuracy, preferably high accuracy to begin with, but at least we wanted a reasonable assurance that they'd be high accuracy after we were a couple years into the project when we really would be moving into this validation phase. We wanted them influential within their breeds. We wanted these sires really to represent the germplasm that's influential within each of the breeds, but also the breadth of influential germplasm within the breeds. So we have now received all of the semen on the bulls, and the genotyping with the 50K chip is completed. We've had those genotypes available to us for about a month and a half now. We've been working with those, doing several different kinds of analyses. I just think it's useful to look back at this 50K chip has just generated an enormous number of genotypes, 250 million genotypes. Whereas before we had the 50K chip, we had generated about 1.7 million genotypes, and we undoubtedly spent a lot more money to get those first 1.7 million than we did to get the 250 million from the 50K chip. So the technology has really changed just in the last couple of years. I'm going to go through with you what we're using for training data for the project. And the primary training data that we're using comes from our germplasm evaluation project at the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center. And there's basically three different subsets of that project that we're using. And I'll go through each of those in detail. But the first is the F1 generation from Cycle 7 of the GP project. Then we have what we call an F1 squared generation of that project. I'll show you that in a little more detail. And then finally, we have changed the overall structure of that project so that we now are sampling these 16 breeds that I mentioned earlier on a continuous basis. And we have a few of basically the first year of progeny out of that sampling that we have collected 50K data on, and they'll be a part of this as well. So the Cycle 7 population out of the Germplasm Evaluation Project sampled these seven breeds of sire. These are the seven breeds that register the most cattle in the U.S. They're all Bosporus breeds, Angus, Hereford, Red Angus, the three British breeds, and the Continental breeds are Simmental, Charley, Limousin, and Gelvie down here. We mated these seven breeds of sire to base cows that we had at the research center. And about half of those base cows were composite Mark III. That's a composite that's three-quarter British and a quarter Continental. About a third of those cows were Angus, and about a sixth of them were Hereford. So we produced an F1 generation. We had, in the first couple of years, we castrated the male calves, and they produced steers. It went through extensive evaluations, especially for carcass traits. We produced some F1 bulls in a third year, and we retained those as bulls. And then we produced about 650 F1 cows from these matings that we, F1 females that we retained as cows. We mated these F1 bulls in multiple sire, multiple breed pastures to the F1 cows, and that to produce what we call F1 squared cattle. And these could be anywhere from pure F2s. There's approximately one-seventh of those cattle would be F2s, larger number of three-way crosses, and then most of them were four-way cross calves. So it was random whether which breed of sire was mated to which breed of cow. The F1 bulls were produced only from Angus and Hereford dams in equal numbers. And we produced then about 1,250 of these F1 squared steers. And an equal number of F1 squared females that we're evaluating as cows, but only the last 3 years of the heifers went through feed efficiency measurements, and so we've collected 50K data on the last three calf crops of the cows, and so that's about 750 cows that we have 50K data on, about right at 1,300 steers that we have 50K data on. And then in the new continuous sampling of GPE, we're sampling these 16 breeds. Again, these are the 16 breeds that register the most progeny in the U.S. and that also have a national cattle evaluation for beef production traits. The dams that we're breeding them to are a little broader cross-section. They include our traditional base cows for GPE, but they also include our purebred herds of Charolais and Simmental, as well as the F1 cows from cycle 7. And as we move into the future, what these cows really will be replaced with is whatever cows we're evaluating for maternal and reproductive traits in the GPE project. So we'll continue to breed those cows to purebred AI sires. This again gives us F1 and back cross steers. We're still producing F1 bulls. We'll have F1 and back cross heifers. And we will breed these F1 heifers back to F1 bulls. The back cross heifers will be bred to purebred bulls to grade up towards purebreds for each of these breeds. So this is kind of the population structure that we're dealing with. And then this is the summary of what we have for records for the various traits. And I won't go through all of the numbers on here, but what we have for training data, these in cycle 7 in the F1 generation, cycle 7 altogether, we had about 150 AI sires that produced cycle 7, about 22 sires per breed roughly. So we've got F1 bulls, F1 steers, F1 cows, F1 squared steers, F1 squared cows. I've described each of those populations to you. We collect a variety of different traits on these animals. Obviously, we try to get pretty comprehensive weights on all of these cattle. In some of the populations, we get feed efficiency, and that's primarily on these F1 squared animals. We try to get carcass data on all of the steers that we produce, meat quality, meat composition, female fertility on those females that go into the cow herd. Next one, mature maintenance, longevity. And then on the bulls that we produce, we do get an evaluation of male fertility. Obviously, the numbers that we have to evaluate there are very small and very not really feasible to do a genome scan for those. But data is so limited for those traits, I still think it's a valuable resource for us, particularly where we're using these F1 bulls in multiple sire pastures and then using paternity testing to follow up on how many progeny they've produced. In the new GPE continuous sampling phase, then we have about 135 additional AI sires that were used in that phase. Another set of F1 bulls, F1 steers, F1 heifers, and you can see the total numbers of animals. All of these animals have 50K chip data except for the F1 cows that produce three or more progeny, and we have 50K data on their sires as well, so we can infer the 50K genotypes fairly effectively on those cows that produce more progeny with 50K data. Those cows that produced fewer progeny, we went ahead and ran the 50K chip on so that we didn't have any selection bias on the fertility traits, etc. So in this phase of our project, we have about 250 AI bulls that have the EPDs for information, nearly 4,000 for weight traits, nearly 2,600 for feed efficiency as younger animals. I'll go ahead and mention that there should be 362 that have individual feed intake as mature cows. We'll add to that on the F1 squared cows when they get a little bit older. What next? Around 2,000 animals with carcass traits, around 1,300 with female fertility with more to come, and around 640 that we'll be looking at for longevity, and a little over 100 for male fertility traits, and we'll add to that over time. So it'll be a while before this one pays off for us, but in the long run it should be valuable information. This is preliminary results on SNP associations, and what we're looking at here is this x-axis is position along the genome, and these vertical lines indicate the demarcation between chromosomes. This first line, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Warren, this is those SNPs that have not been assigned to a chromosome, and then this section would be chromosome 1 and on across to the end. They're colored based on the level of significance that we saw, so these are blue are the ones that are really significant. As you can see, we get significant associations throughout the whole genome. Mike indicated to us yesterday that's what we probably should expect to see, although we can't assume that all of these are real associations. What we're going to be looking at here is a mixture of real associations and associations that occur just due to chance. And so the interesting question to ask then is, what's the proportion of those that we would expect to be real versus those that we would expect to be due to chance? And so I'm going to go through a kind of detailed example for birth weight, and then we'll generalize it across other traits that we've looked at as well. For birth weight, we had a total of 2,578 animals. We analyzed about 44,600 SNPs. Now you might say, well, what happened to the other 5,000 or 6,000 SNPs that make up 50,000? There's actually more than 50,000 on the chip. But we analyzed only those where the minor allele frequency was at least 5%. If we look at SNPs where we have more than 95% of the animals with one allele, they really are not very informative, and then the statistics are not particularly well behaved. So we've just excluded those from the results that we're presenting to you. So for birth weight, the number of SNPs that we had that were significant at 10 to the minus 4th was 308 SNPs. Now, if we took 10 to the minus 4th times 44,600 SNPs, their significance, the significance level is saying what proportion of those associations would we expect to see just due to chance if none of these SNPs were having any biological effect at all. Okay? And so 10 to the minus 4th times this number here gives us 4.4 SNP that we would expect to see just due to chance. Now, in reality, it may be more than that because of violations of the statistical assumptions, but it shouldn't be just grossly greater than this number. And so the interesting thing to ask then is, what proportion of the significant associations that we saw, the highly significant associations, are expected to be due just to chance? And we call that the false discovery rate, or FDR. In this case, it's about 1.4%. So I'm going to go through with you on the next slide a summary of what's in this column. We're not going to walk through all those steps again, though, each time. So here we go. Here's the list of traits that we're looking at. The number of animals that were informative, the number of significant SNPs, the number of significant associations we would expect due just a chance, and the false discovery rate. These three columns are for a fairly stringent statistical significance criteria of 10 to the minus 4th, where you see that our expected number of significant associations is quite small. And then we also looked at it with a p-value of 10 to the minus 3, where our expected number of false associations is 10 times as large, but you'll see that also the number of significant SNPs that we found at that level also is getting pretty large. And if we drop this by another order of magnitude, then the number expected goes up, but again, the number of significant SNPs grows quite a bit more. And if we take all that together, it indicates we've got an awful lot of significant SNPs out there that are real. The ones that are significant at this level, we can have reasonably good confidence are real, particularly for these traits over here like birth weight and yearling weight, where this false discovery rate is very low. We can be pretty confident that those SNPs really have some effect. Weaning weight and milk aren't too bad. When we get into traits where we have fewer phenotypes, you'll see this false discovery rate starts to creep up. There's a few traits here that for some reason our false discovery rate gets quite a bit higher, so that we really, even at 10 to the minus 4th for a significance level, we don't have a lot of confidence in those associations. So for those, we'll have to go to an even more stringent significance level to have any confidence in those SNPs, and we're not going to explain very much variation with only a very small handful of SNPs that are significant at a high enough level that our false discovery rate is reasonably low. But the idea of whole genome selection is that we don't have to live with just these SNPs that are at the very extreme of significance level, but instead we can start to incorporate these SNPs where we're less certain. We incorporate that ambiguity and we account for it appropriately in the statistical model. And so with whole genome selection, we put more emphasis on these, but there's a big number of these. We put less number on each one individually, but they allow us to account for additional genetic variation. And probably if we go on out and looked at another column at p less than 0.01, we could pick up some additional genetic variation by moving out there as well. So we've just started looking at predictions of genetic merit. As was indicated by all three of the morning speakers yesterday, and if we think about it, it makes perfectly good sense. The predictions of EPDs of cattle closely related to the training data. So, for example, if we looked at the AI sires that were used to produce the cycle 7 population, we got quite good correlations between our predictions and their EPDs, which came from different sets of data, but they're genetically related to one another quite closely. So, you know, you can start out feeling good about that, but then you realize, well, you know, that's really not the problem that we're trying to solve with the project. So we've looked in at how good are our predictions from the training data relative to the EPD of AI bulls that did not sire progeny in the training data. And it's not as good as we think it needs to be. We're going to have to go back and do more work on that. We've got a lot of ideas that we want to pursue, but we're not ready to release anything on that at this point in time. I mentioned earlier one of the things we were really interested in is how well did our predictions of molecular breeding values from the cycle 7 breeds where our training data is work on the other 7 breeds that were not included in the training data. And right now, depending on what kind of analysis we use, we get kind of mixed results. It actually maybe doesn't look quite as pessimistic as what we've heard yesterday, but my gut feeling is what we heard yesterday is more right than the favorable side of the mixed results. So, but we'll be exploring that in more detail as we go forward because it's really a critically important question that we need to answer, and I think we have a good resource to look at that with. So thus far we've tried just two fairly basic statistical approaches to predicting genetic merit. As I indicated a minute ago, there's a lot of approaches yet to be tried, and we're going to be exploring that very vigorously in the coming months. If we look at what's happened in human genetics, there's kind of a debate going on right now, but you know, human geneticists have had access to much higher density chips than 50K to use in whole genome association studies that attempt to explain quantitative variation in disease risk. And they're finding that whole genome association has been more challenging, explained less of the genetic variation than they initially expected. And some of our speakers yesterday addressed this, and it's really pretty amazing that when we stop to think that the big effects that we find are about 1% of genetic variation, and then they tail off from there. So that should indicate that we should expect this to be a challenging problem for us as we go forward. One of the potential explanations that has been proposed is that much of the variation that we see is due just to very rare alleles that occur at a low frequency in the population in total. But there are so many of these very rare alleles that cumulatively they contribute an awful lot to genetic variation. And if that's the case, it's going to make this even probably more breed specific and maybe even more family specific than we had hoped it was going to be. Now it's probably not as challenging in cattle as it is in humans because we've gone through some bottlenecks and our effective population size is much, much smaller. But I think that there's a lot to be learned from what's going on in human genetics, and it suggests that we have some challenges ahead of us, and I think we may have to rethink how we're going to apply this technology in beef cattle breeding. And it may be that we have to incorporate more of a family-specific approach than what we had been planning on. Experience in dairy cattle breeding, whole genome selection is being used to select young bulls to progeny test. The initial results look promising. But the situation in dairy is quite different than what we have in beef. Of course, first of all, there's primarily one breed of main interest, at least in the U.S. But the training data essentially is the whole breed. And so if you train across that entire breed, then your training data is really closely related to where you want to apply it. And in fact, where you want to apply it is just the next generation past the training data almost. And so that's a much easier objective to achieve than in beef cattle, where we'd almost like to be able to train in one set of breeds and predict in a different set of breeds. Ideally, at least to reach into some of our smaller breeds. And in the less challenging case, we need to be able to predict from a relatively small set of animals that are extensively phenotyped for rare traits, or traits for which phenotypes are not commonly available. And then we want to extend that across a whole breed or a whole range of breeds. And so that's a challenging thing to do as well. And one of the things I want to point out about the differences between the beef and dairy approaches is that from what I understand thus far, the dairy approach has really focused on the milk production traits that are extensively recorded in the dairy industry. So the animals in which the technology is being applied are very closely related to the animals that have phenotypes. And in beef cattle, we've said we want to do exactly the opposite. Don't even give us DNA tests for weight traits. We can do that through EPDs. You know, give us disease resistance and feed efficiency and fertility and all these things that we don't have EPDs for. You know, we don't want the animals we're selecting to be anywhere close to the ones that we have phenotypes on. And that's starting to look like that's going to be a pretty tall order, and we may have to reevaluate how phenotypes are collected relative to candidates for selection. So I think we've got a lot to learn in that regard as we go forward. But there are pretty distinct differences between what we've aimed to do in beef cattle and what dairy cattle is doing, and really, frankly, what any of the other major species that are using this approach have attempted to do. So our initial emphasis is going to be on the weight traits, because that is the set of traits where we do have extensive phenotypic recording in those animals in which we want to apply the test. And we have the most phenotypes within our discovery population for those traits. We know a lot about how those traits behave, and so it's the set of traits for which we're likely to have a success the soonest. It also is going to be the best set of traits with which to explore how well these DNA tests are going to work across a variety of breeds, including those breeds that were not included in the discovery data set. So we'll be able to validate these MBVs for weight traits against the EPDs of the industry AI sires. And I should mention the other advantage we have is the industry AI sires generally have high accuracy EPDs for the weight traits. When we start moving into carcass traits, those accuracies go down quite a bit. And as we move into some of the other traits, those EPDs are just simply non-existent. So it's really the place where we have the most opportunity to learn in the shortest amount of time. That's where our initial focus will be. We are continuing to develop training data. We're currently sampling about 80 to 100 new sires per year in our germplasm evaluation project. So we're producing those cattle. We're phenotyping them as best we have the funding to do. We've basically used our funding for the 50K chip that we have in hand. So we're going to have to be looking for sources of funding to continue that onto these new animals that we're producing as we go forward. But the animals will be there, and we will phenotype them as extensively as we can. We do have cow capacity to sample more sires, but we've changed. That's because we've changed the mating system at the center. We're evaluating more animals today than we we did in the past. We have capacity to do more, but our budget just hasn't caught up with our capacity to produce animals that are relevant for phenotyping. So, in terms of validation, as everybody's indicated, it's pretty easy to explain a lot of the genetic variation within the discovery data. It's a lot more difficult to explain much of the variation within the validation data, within validation data that's completely independent of the discovery data. I don't really think that completely independent of the discovery data is what our standard should be. I think several of the speakers yesterday alluded to this concept as well, but what we really need to achieve is that our validation data should be related, the population should be genetically related to about the same extent to our discovery population as what the application population is to the discovery. So we want this genetic relationship and this genetic relationship to at least be in the ballpark. It's going to be difficult to make them identical, but we don't really need to aim for being completely independent here, but we can't be really closely related here and more distantly related here. So it's going to be a fine line to try to walk, but we're going to have to keep this in mind. And I think that as we go forward, we may be coming to the breed associations or genetic evaluation providers to try to give us measures of how related individuals within some of these populations are to the breed, so that we can try to balance that as best we can. So the validation resources that we're looking at are the part of the 2000 Bull Project that's not included in the it's not sires of the discovery population. Gary Bennett's going to talk later about this international collaboration. I'll move on through it. For industry application of the project, when we're confident that we've gotten what we can out of the data, we'll provide molecular breeding values on all 2,000 of the industry AI sires that we've run the chip across. We'll provide those breeding values to the breed associations to provide on to their members and hopefully to the public. As I said before, the initial focus will be on the weight traits, for which high-accuracy EPD are available. Carcass traits will probably follow. And then the loftier goal, and the one that I know everybody's really more interested in, is the difficult traits like feed efficiency. But from where we see things today, we're just going to have to take these things in steps as we can do it reliably. So to wrap up, the industry sire sampling is complete. The lab work is complete. We're working on the statistical analysis. We have a lot to do. The preliminary results suggest that we have a lot of room for improvement. We had hoped for a really ambitious time frame to have these things to you. We're still working diligently to try to do it as rapidly as we can. But at this point, you know, I really can't tell you when that is going to be. It just depends on how we progress and when we can get to the level of confidence that we feel we need in order to go forward. So with that, I'll stop and take any questions that you might have. Yes?